house environment and the outside house environment, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of coordination of factors and elements of raising children. And obviously, we said there are many factors. Now, there is another factor that generally people think, like, if we have less kids, less children, we can train them better. Whereas in the Islamic teachings, in the narrations, it is emphasized to have more kids, more children. One of the reason is that having more children makes training children easier, makes raising children according to the Islamic lifestyle or Islamic teaching easier. Why? Because in raising kids, in raising children, in training the children, the factor which has more impact on our children is the existence of their elder brother or sister. So if we have put our all potential on the first two kids, for example, or maybe the first child who is either a boy or a girl, and we could train him or her in the best way, the rest of children, they follow their brother and sister. They see what their brother is doing, they see what their sister is doing, and they're trying to copy. And they want to be someone like them because they are attached to you and they're helping you in the house. And what you do, they are doing the same thing. So the children at the in the house who are small, they try to follow them. They try to follow their footsteps. And it makes your life easy. It makes your life easy because you have put all your potential in the first two children, and the rest of the children are just following their brothers and sisters. Therefore, we need to also emphasize and pay attention to this factor as well, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
the limelight.
In its propaganda portraying itself as a champion of human rights, the U.S. declared that wherever they may be in the world, a child is a child first and foremost. But it appears that when it comes to Palestinian children, only exceptional cases like those of Amal Nakhle merit EU sympathy. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Tamara Nassar, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "For EU, a child is a child, except when Palestinian." Stay tuned for more. There are growing calls on the Zionist regime to immediately release a medically vulnerable Palestinian teen who has been imprisoned for more than a year without charge or trial. Amal Nakhle was 17, a child, when the Zionist regime authorities arrested him in January 2021. He lives with a rare chronic autoimmune disease. He recently tested positive for the coronavirus, which heightens the concern about his well-being because his condition places him at increased risk of serious illness. Following the positive coronavirus test, the Zionist regime transferred Nakhle to the Ramal prison clinic, which is nicknamed the slaughterhouse by detained Palestinians. Since his arrest, the Zionist regime military has held Nakhle in administrative detention, which can be renewed indefinitely. Under the most recent renewal earlier this month, Nakhle will be detained until at least 18th of May. Like all other administrative detainees, Nakhle is held based on secret evidence that the Zionist regime military authorities refused to show to him or his lawyers. Several UN agencies are urging Nakhle's immediate and unconditional release. Amal's case is one of the more prolonged cases where a Palestinian child has been detained without charge or trial, said the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights in a joint appeal with Children's Agency UNICEF and Palestine Refugee Agency UNRWA. It is, however, not an isolated case. Currently, at least another three Palestinians are in administrative detention who were under the age of 18 when first detained, the UN agencies added. In December, the UN Human Rights Council's Working Group on Arbitrary Detention issued an opinion on Nakhle's case, concluding that the Zionist regime should release him immediately. Uncharacteristically, the European Union also called on the Zionist regime to release Nakhle, as did the Irish diplomatic mission in the occupied West Bank. The EU mission in the West Bank said recently that Nakhle must be released immediately. EU representatives rarely intervene on behalf of Palestinian prisoners held by the Zionist regime. When they do comment, it is usually in the advanced stages of a hunger strike. Even then, the EU does not demand their release. At most, the EU calls for the detainee to be charged and receive a fair trial. But there is no such thing as a fair trial for Palestinians subjected to the Zionist regime military occupation. Palestinians from the West Bank are subject to the Zionist regime's military tribunals, which have a near 100% conviction rate. A feature of the Zionist regime system of apartheid is that Jewish settlers living in the West Bank are not subject to the military tribunals, but to the Zionist regime's civilian courts. Previously, the EU urged that the Zionist regime hold the extensive use of administrative detention, implying the practice may be used, if more sparingly. But most commonly, the EU expresses varying levels of concern. In short, in the rare cases when the EU is not silent about the thousands of Palestinian political prisoners, including children, held by the Zionist regime, its statements are muted and late. Of course, Amal Nakhle must be released immediately and unconditionally, as should all Palestinian children and political detainees held by the Zionist regime. The Zionist regime is holding 160 other Palestinian children, and 500 Palestinians are currently imprisoned without charge or trial. The Zionist regime is the only regime in the world that routinely subjects children, and only Palestinian children, to military tribunals. But it is notable that the EU is only willing to demand the immediate and unconditional release of Nakhle. Could it be that EU officials are willing to do so only because he can be portrayed as sufficiently deserving of their sympathy due to his medical condition? In his propaganda portraying itself as a champion of human rights, the EU has declared that, wherever they may be in the world, a child is a child first and foremost. Every child's rights must be, therefore, fully and equally protected. But it appears that, when it comes to Palestinian children, only exceptional cases like those of Amal Nakhle merit EU sympathy. Nakhle and the hundreds of other Palestinians arbitrarily imprisoned by the occupier are currently boycotting the Zionist regime's military courts. The protest was launched on the first day of the year as an act of collective resistance to a system Israeli human rights group B'Tselem describes as a Kafka's legal reality.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the merciful, salam, dear listeners, my brothers and sisters from every single corner in the world, wherever you are, I hope you're doing well. This is IRB English Radio, and here is your favorite youth station. My name is Asma.
Choo-choo-ka-choo, it's the youth station for
yes.
You. That is
that's
our
the slogan.
Tagline.
Yes,
right
that's
there.
The tag. My name is Asma, and I'm glad to be at your service, sharing some priceless moments together here with us. We have
Muzaffar Haider.
Yes, we have our brother Muzaffar. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, though I have a little cold, but it's okay.
Inshallah, may Allah bless you and protect you, inshallah.
Yes, thank you very much. It's not Corona, though. Well, speaking of cold and sickness, mm-hmm. There was a time in my life, I'm talking of my own personal experience right now, when I experienced a time, an era in my life where everything was falling apart and they were running out of my control.
Mm-hmm.
At the very beginning of the pandemic, my father got sick, like very sick, in a very bad way. And there was not much of knowledge about the sickness.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he got the worst form of it.
Mm-hmm.
And all we had to do was just praying. Beside our personal problems, there was a sickness, mm-hmm. and everything was just running out of control. I'm just thinking about some other people who are going through some exact situations like me. In those times, you really are hopeless. You don't know what you're going to do.
So I was talking to my friend and he was like really miserable. He was down, you know, he's one of those friends who's always upset, right? And I wanted to cheer him up. I said, listen, he was like, no, it's really bad right now. I was like, listen, just to give you some comfort, it's not just you that's suffering right now. The entire world is in like a bad place right now.
Yes.
And not to sound insensitive, like I understand that it
no,
was...
No, that's sympathizing, actually.
But for me...
At the moment, it's very difficult for the one to understand that.
Right, but for me, it was like, okay, it's almost like you feel a togetherness with others when you start to realize it in that way. Because sometimes, you know, you're in a difficult situation and nobody can understand it.
Yes, exactly.
But then I feel like in the corona times, humanity's a very weird part of it has started to identify
to
itself.
To show up, yes.
Yeah, you know,
we're
it
all
realizes,
the same, in the same
yeah,
boat.
Yeah, we're all in the same boat. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. It doesn't matter if you're this or that. You know, we're
everyone is vulnerable.
Asantum, asantum.
Recommendations for those who are feeling they're in a time that everything is falling apart and everything is going out of control and they don't know what they should do.
I want to say patience, but it would sound like so much of a cliche. Like, oh,
do you practice that?
I try, but I'm very impatient, if I'm being totally honest, you know.
I think everyone is so impatient.
Exactly. We are
That's our essence.
We're very, very weak. You know, mankind has been created weak and we are, you know, a little bit of pressure and we buckle.
Yes, exactly.
And you know, one extraordinary thing that I really did experience just recently is I was going through a sickness, right? I was just sick.
Yes.
You know, that's all, I was sick. And at one point, I was just like, astaghfirullah, I shouldn't even be saying this.
Yes, I know what you mean. That happens to everyone.
You know, I just felt like, God, why?
Yes.
For crying out loud, why? You know?
And right now, why right now?
But as soon as I said that, it kind of just stopped. And it was really bizarre because I actually felt that that was Allah's test and I had just failed.
Yes, that's true. You know? It happened to me too.
You know, and I wish I had not lost my temper. I wish I'd been more patient.
Yes, but that's very difficult.
It's very difficult.
Very difficult.
And before that, though, I was like, you know, Ya Allah, I want to be like Prophet Ayyub.
Yes.
You know, Prophet Ayyub
but
would
the
put
pressure,
through so
the,
many.
But the pressure, exactly when you say that, the pressure is more visible.
Uh-huh.
And then right after that, you would lose your temper.
Oh, yeah, you do. Practically speaking, it's a whole different story. And,
yes.
And most of us do fail. We can't put up with a little bit of tribulation in this world. You know, there's a hadith, sister, that says that those who pass away from here, right, they go into the barzakh, they go into the world of the grave.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them will be wishing that they had been cut to pieces with scissors in
oh
this dunya.
God. Yes, yes.
Because of how much it would have alleviated their pains on that side.
Yes,
get it right. So
that's
the more you suffer,
strange.
Pain really is a cleanser, especially over here.
Yes,
the more suffering you endure over here, the less you will.
There's a growth system behind that, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe God's blessing comes through afflictions. The more you are going through pains, and the more God is taking you in His hands, in His arms. And the more you are going to have blessings. But at the difficult, at those miserable situations that you have, it's very difficult to understand that.
Absolutely,
because days are going so hard and they look like, every day looks like a century. So for a human being who is so weak and fibbling, it's very difficult to tolerate those situations.
When we wake up on that side, like after death, we are going to, literally life is going to feel like the twinkling of an eye or a single day.
Of course, yes.
And yet when you are in that moment of pressure and pain and suffering,
everything
it feels
seems,
like forever.
Yes,
it just
feels
like
forever.
An eternity. I was actually talking to a youth just last night I was trying to explain to this youth about the existence of hell.
Yes.
Lots of people, especially in the Western world, they have a real problem with fathoming or accepting that hell really does exist.
Well, that does exist.
They have a problem accepting it, right?
Because there are those who really deserve to go in hell.
Exactly. And that's exactly what I said. I said, look, those who deserve to go to hell, you don't understand what their essence actually is. If you recognized what a true kafir is, not the average, you know, John or Joe walking down the street,
yes.
But an actual kafir, if you knew what was inside their soul, how psychopathic they are,
how much
they lack empathy, how much hatred and jealousy they have. Right.
How much brutality we've seen through history.
Asantum. But see, I was talking him through this and we came on to the idea of suffering. And this youth, he said something really remarkable. He said, do you know what? I think that Allah created suffering for a reason. And that reason is to reform us.
Exactly. Why? To shape us.
To shape us, right?
Yes.
So the more you suffer, you'll notice that the more you really do shine.
Yes,
right?
Like the story of diamonds, they go through so much of pressures.
Right?
And scientifically speaking, we could say that the more they go through pressures, the more beautiful and precious they are.
It's the hardest substance that we know of.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Okay, so then he said, okay, that explains hell. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, if suffering was created for our reformation, if we refuse to reform ourselves,
yes,
the suffering will continue. And it will get worse and worse and worse. And that's why they are in hell.
Yes, that's very true.
Isn't that profound?
Yes, of course.
See, one thing I've learned talking to youths is that you don't always need to give them answers. If you just ask them the right questions, they come up with the right answers themselves.
Little by little, step by step, we get to the conclusion that there is a reason behind suffering.
But since we're on the subject of patience, I came across a really scary verse of the Quran. It said that those who are put into hell, they'll be told, now, if you be patient or you be impatient, it will make no difference.
Exactly.
You are going to be in hell
now. The time has passed.
Allah,
you have done what you have done.
Right? So even if a person says, you know, I'm going to be patient and endure this patiently, does not make a difference. You're in hell now.
Yes.
It doesn't change. Okay, so now let's come out of hell for a moment, come back
yes.
to ourselves, right?
So we're speaking of the situations where everything is going out of control.
Yeah, yeah.
And we talked about patience and we said that practicing patience is very difficult, but it has got some blessing in the end.
Absolutely. So there's this verse, hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Yes.
He says that there are 2 days in a man's life, one which is with him and one which is against him.
Yes, against him.
As for the day which is with him, he should be thankful.
Don't be so happy.
He should be thankful.
Yes.
Right? And as for the day which is against him, he should be patient.
Patient, yes.
And I really do feel like, and I feel like a hypocrite for saying this because I don't practice it. May Allah give me the tawfiq to practice it.
Of course, to every single one of us.
Islam is actually showing us a kind of ilahi amin, a kind of attitude that we're supposed to develop.
Yes.
We don't have this attitude.
Yeah.
You know, sister, I was talking to a brother who was actually anxious. He was suffering anxieties and stuff, right? And I told him this hadith, and he said, yeah, I know. I said, but then he goes, but when I'm having a good day, I'm worried that it's going to turn bad
exactly.
any moment.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
He's just worried.
That's one of my anxieties as well.
There you go. And we all
so
do
we
it.
Don't even enjoy the good days.
Exactly. Now, what is Ali alayhi salam telling us here? He's telling us when you're having a good day,
just be thankful.
Be thankful. Don't be worrying, oh, it's going to turn bad any moment.
Yeah.
Any moment now, a boulder is going to fall on my head. It's
you know,
start
as you
raining.
Get older and you're more experienced,
you become pessimistic.
Based on your experiences, you become pessimistic.
So what Islam is actually teaching us is, look, you're going to have ups and downs.
Yes.
Right? Enjoy the ups. Be thankful
and
for the ups.
And don't think about the downs.
Yeah, and when you're in the downs, be patient. You're going
yes,
to go up again
going,
eventually,
yes,
right?
Yes, you're going to be out
but
of
we
it.
We don't practice that attitude we're supposed to have, you see?
Yes, exactly. Well, there's exactly where we're going for a little break. Hope you're not tired. Don't go anywhere. Stick to Youth Station. We'll be back as fast as the wind.
This This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So welcome back to your own program, the most desired station in life, Youth Station. This is IRIB English Radio and Asma is talking to you here with us. We have Brother Muzaffar and we're discussing some very fascinating topics. We were talking about controlling things, coping with things, and not losing temper, which is a very difficult topic.
Mm-hmm. I actually had a question for you. So you went through that really difficult time.
Yes.
How did you get through it?
I just prayed a lot, and God is the only thing that you can clinch into. Mm-hmm. The only thing, the only thought that made me a little bit easier with the situation and alleviated me for a while was that God is watching us, and he, of course, would not leave the person who is lying on him, who's leaning on him, who's trusting him. He would never let you down. That was the only thing that made me stick together and go on.
Mm-hmm. According to Shahid Dasghib, Ayatollah Dasghib,
yes,
in his book Greater Sins, I believe he lists after shirk is the number one greatest sin, according
yes,
to him.
Yes, and then despair.
The second one is despair.
Yes.
Despair, not alcohol, not riba,
yes,
not
and God has always told us not to go into that phase when you are hopeless and you think there is no hope.
Yeah.
That's the worst thing that could ever happen to a person.
Yeah.
Because that's the easiest thing when it creeps in your thought.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It is very much around you. It ambushes you wherever you are. It's the easiest one, the one who is always beside you. But you shouldn't give it like leaves and let it grow.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You should just go for hope. Hope is the last thing that die.
See, this despair is actually kufr.
Exactly.
It's actually disbelief.
Yes.
And you might not openly announce, or even to yourself announce, that I no longer believe in God.
Na'udhu billah.
Or I no longer believe in the Quran. I no longer believe in the Prophet. You might not ever say that or ever think that.
Yes.
But you see, just like we're talking about different attitudes, there is an attitude of Islam, which is that attitude of thankfulness and patience.
Yes, true.
There's an attitude of kufr.
Yes.
And that attitude is despair. It is to kind of let go and be like, yeah, God is there, but he ain't going to help me.
May he forgive us.
May he forgive us, honestly, because we've actually committed that great sin.
Well, just like this, in a blink of an eye, we get to the tail end of another topic in Youth Station. Hope you all enjoyed it wholeheartedly. This was IRIB English Radio, and I was Asma with Brother Muzaffar. We were super pleased to be with you until another session of Youth Station. I ask Allah to keep you all safe and sound. May Allah be always on your side.
Reporting reveals the households of at least 28 U.S. senators own a combined minimum of $3.7 million and as much as $12.6 million in fossil fuel assets. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, 1 in 4 U.S. senators still hold fossil fuel investments, even as world burns. Stay tuned for more. A new report published recently reveals that the members of the U.S. Senate who would have to pass climate legislation are heavily invested in the fossil fuel industry. Sludge reports the households of at least 28 U.S. senators in both the Democratic and Republican caucuses hold a combined minimum of $3.7 million and as much as $12.6 million in fossil fuel investments. According to the report, of the 28 senators, at least 20 hold publicly traded stocks in companies like oil supermajor Chevron, pipeline giant Enterprise Products, or electric utility NextEra that belong to trade associations that are lobbying Congress against taking up a strong legislation to curb polluting emissions. Five U.S. senators are invested in energy funds built around oil and gas assets, and three own non-public stock in private fossil fuel companies. The investments held by the senators, their spouse, jointly, or a dependent, are disclosed to the Senate Office of Public Records in very broad ranges and often buried in hundreds of pages of scanned paper forms, making a more precise count of their total value impossible. At least half a dozen of the senators sit on environment or climate-related committees. The Household of State Energy and Natural Resources Committee Chair Joe Manchin, who has worked incessantly to destroy or dilute climate action in the Build Back Better Act and beyond, has received over $1 million in income from Ener Systems, a coal brokerage firm the senator founded in 1980s. According to Sludge, Manchin has stripped the Democrats' budget reconciliation bill of major climate programs that would have transitioned coal-fired plants, like the one where the company now run by his son holds the prime fuel services contract, while the committee he chairs also added more than $11.3 billion in funding to the bipartisan infrastructure bill that could benefit his family company's niche, waste coal industry. Other Democratic senators whose households are heavily invested in fossil fuels include John Hickenlooper, holds up to $1 million in investments in Chevron and other polluters. Tom Carper owns as much as $274,000 in Chevron and Duke Energy shares. Gary Peters has up to $355,000 in NextEra, DTE Energy, and Pacific Gas and Electric stock in his portfolio. And the wife of Angus King, a Maine independent who caucuses with Democrats, owns up to $50,000 worth of NextEra shares. Earlier this year, Common Dreams reported that six Democratic senators, including Manchin, Chris Coons, Maggie Hassan, Mark Kelly, Kristen Sinema, and John Tester, have received hundreds of thousands of dollars in combined campaign contributions from fossil fuel corporations, some of which have touted their purported support for climate action over the past decade. The investments are valued at a combined minimum of $3.7 million and a maximum of $12.6 million, and many of them have been held by the lawmakers for at least 3 years. Of the 28 senators, at least 20 hold publicly traded stocks in companies like oil supermajor Chevron, pipeline giant Enterprise Products, or electric utility NextEra that belong to trade associations that are lobbying Congress against taking up a strong legislation to curb polluting emissions. Five senators are invested in energy funds built around oil and gas assets, and three own non-public stock in private fossil fuel companies. The UK research group Influence Map, which analyzes lobbying and communications, this month found that ExxonMobil and Chevron are the top two most negatively influential global companies on Paris-aligned climate policy. Exxon has spent about $4.6 million on political and social issue ads on Facebook so far this year, promoting itself as part of the climate change solution, while its officials hold leadership positions in trade groups including API and U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Chevron's first ever climate lobbying report this year did not attempt to reckon with its trade association's lobbying against policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. In total, senators' households have as much as $275,000 invested in ExxonMobil and as much as $370,000 invested in Chevron. Influence Maps analysis found that the most negatively influential lobby groups on emissions policy were API, AFPM, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and the National Mining Association. API's millions spent on Facebook ads this year have recently opposed the Build Back Better Act as anti-industry legislation and have promoted natural gas as a solution. A 2019 report from over a dozen major environmental groups, including 350 and the Center for Biological Diversity, found that leaking methane from gas energy would push the world over the emissions bounds of the Paris Agreement. A conclusion affirmed in May by the International Energy Agency, which backed the winding down by 2040 of oil, gas, and coal power plants. Rick Scott, who won his Florida seat by 0.2% of general election vote in 2018, reported that his spouse holds an investment worth up to $500,000 in AG Energy Credit Appointments Fund, IVLP. Announced last year, the fund aimed to raise $1.5 billion to buy the distressed debt of oil and gas companies and was affected by Angelo Gordon, a New York-based alternative investment firm that extends credit to companies in a North American oil and gas company. Several senators have disclosed selling off fossil fuel industry investments since their 2019 reports. Ron Wyden's spouse sold up to $50,000 in ExxonMobil on August 21st. Divesting in full from ExxonMobil, as well as from shares in industrial conglomerate General Electric, whose stock is owned by at least five other senators. Dianne Feinstein no longer reports an asset of $1,000 in gas company Antero Midstream that she and her investor spouse held in 2019. Republican John Hoven of North Dakota, the ranking member of the Subcommittee on Energy and a member of the Appropriations Subcommittee on Energy, no longer reports holding several oil assets that he did in 2019, including stock in Chevron, ExxonMobil, Marathon, and others that had been worth a combined $550,000 maximum. The average age of a senator at the start of the 117th Congress was 64.3 years, according to the Congressional Research Service. The median age of the 28 senators, including in this analysis, is 66 years, topped by Angus King at 77, Joe Manchin and Tom Carper at 74, and John Boozman at 70. Based on average U.S. life expectancy, most of the Senate fossil fuel investors will be dead before the plant reaches 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming above pre-industrial levels, as projected by the UN, to hit between 2030 and 2052, beyond which the most deadly impacts of climate change will begin being felt by those still alive.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Enmity of arrogant powers towards Iran originates from Leather's anti-arrogance and colonialist spirit. This is the part of a televised speech delivered on January 9, 2022, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the anniversary of an uprising by the people of Qom on January 9, 1978.
The January 9th uprising was a brilliant combination of zeal and rationality. These events form our history, and we must learn from them. But a nation that is alive does not look only at the past. It also looks at the next step to be taken and the horizons ahead in every stage of its history. In accordance with the developments of its time and in accordance with the duties that fall on that nation, we must identify the task to be done at the present moment. We must determine our steps for the future. And we must identify the horizon, fix our eyes on it, and move towards it with all our strength and power. In this way, the movement will be successful in the real sense of the word. In addition, it will achieve the final victory, which is first of all a pure life for the Iranian nation. If others learn from it, and if it becomes a model, this is another issue. But we should achieve prosperity and an Islamic lifestyle, which is a pure life that has worldly comforts, has both religion and welfare, and is good for both the body and the soul.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
At the present time, we are in the middle of the path. Of course, part of the way has been travelled up until today. The Iranian nation has worked hard, and we have moved forward a little. But we should identify what our duty is today and what our duty and horizons are for the future as well. Sometimes one sees that they carry out polls. For example, they ask the opinion of the people. But these things do not show the truth of the Iranian nation. The truth of the Iranian nation is shown by the funeral of Martyr Soleimani. It is these things that show the mood of the Iranian nation and what their sentiments and feelings are. In other words, in order to understand the reality and feelings of this nation, a domain as great and vast as the country and people of Iran is needed. Therefore, the polls that some groups carry out here and there, some of which have ulterior motives behind them, and some of which are innocent, cannot be a criterion in this regard.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me.
Of Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
After the Friday prayers, people gathered to protest against Saudi Arabia's ongoing war on Yemen, demanding Prime Minister Imran Khan to use his influence to stop the Saudi war on Yemen.
Yemenis' chants are down with USA, down with Israel, and down with Al Saud. They're the best Muslims who are fighting with Israel and other US allies, sacrificing their children and loved ones. Those killing Yemenis are arranging anti-Islamic concerts in the Holy Land in the name of modernity, and even banned recently an Islamic preaching groups from India and Pakistan.
Yemen is facing an unequal war for more than 7 years now. The war has claimed tens of thousands of lives, many of them women and children.
Recently, we are witness that the Yemeni people are more than Palestinian and Kashmiris are oppressed. So it is our duty as a Pakistani, I feel that it's our obligatory duty to stand with the oppressed people of Yemen and to condemn all of the oppressors, including United States, European governments and their puppets, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and other allies.
Rights groups say while countries continue to turn a blind eye, there will be no end in sight to this horrendous conflict that has seen immeasurable suffering inflicted upon the men, women and children of Yemen. Yemenis have been knocking on all doors demanding accountability and justice. Member states owe it to them to take this forward at pace. The welfare of millions is in their hands. Protesters are outraged at the ongoing Saudi atrocities in Yemen. They are calling on the international community to take immediate actions and end the bloodshed. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson coming out fighting this week. Not the contrite, apologetic Prime Minister a week earlier over Partygate, allegations of rule-breaking parties under his roof during lockdown last year.
Even though these things are quite damaging, none of them constitute an artillery shell into his bunker. So that's why Boris is still alive and peddling his pipe.
Boris Johnson's list of problems have grown bigger in recent weeks as more images and allegations of illegal parties at his residence emerged. The result, an official inquiry and a police investigation. The former by senior civil servant Sue Gray. The outcome of those investigations are yet to be published, but the scandal is taking its toll. Apart from the opposition, some members of the Prime Minister's own Conservative Party have called for his head. Others say they're waiting on the Sue Gray report.
Well, of course, we all want to know the story, warts and all, but the police are saying that it would prejudice a police investigation. And much as we don't like that, nobody's going to be able to stop them taking the line that they choose to take. What I fully expect is that the Sue Gray report will reveal more of the same sort of antics.
While some MPs in the Prime Minister's Conservative Party sit on the fence, the Court of Public Opinion has already come up with a verdict.
If he's found to be guilty of these things, then I guess he's got to go.
He should quit. Very hypocritical from start to finish.
Just admit it and just say it happens.
He should resign.
That has meant plunging popularity ratings, a 32-point lead for Labour, meaning some Conservative MPs would face a near wipeout if a general election were to be held now. Add to that a cost of living crisis and fresh accusations of corruption over the funding of his Downing Street flat refurbishment.
It's hardly the first time Boris Johnson is having to wriggle through controversies, but the odds are very different this time. If he is found to have misled Parliament about those parties, he will be in breach of the so-called ministerial code. Saeed Puriza, London.
North Korea Thursday conducted a round of ballistic missiles testing, firing two short-range rockets off its east coast. Analysts suggest North Korean leader Kim Jong-un wants to show his people he's their defender, although the tests have several purposes.
They're trying to make a point regarding the South Korean presidential election. They're trying, I think, to try to intimidate South Koreans into thinking, look, you've got to come to terms with us, the North Koreans.
Since late 2017, North Korea has not conducted a long-range missile test or a nuclear test in the hopes of making a deal with former U.S. President Donald Trump on sanctions relief. No deal has materialized, and leader Kim has recently indicated the moratorium on long-range missile testing and nuclear testing has expired.
He said that he might want to go beyond simply testing missiles, implying, not saying directly, but implying that he might want to test an intercontinental ballistic missile, an ICBM, that's capable of carrying a warhead to the United States. And he might even want to have another underground nuclear test.
The U.S. has criticized the recent testing, while China places the blame for tensions on the U.S. reliance on sanctions on North Korea.
South Koreans will head to the polls to elect a new president on March 9th. With North Korea conducting six rounds of missile tests in just the past month, security, military affairs, and relations between Seoul and Pyongyang are likely to figure heavily in that election. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Shias in Italy, The Path of Minor Islam in Diaspora, is the title of a recent book which illustrates the role, practices, and ethnic composition of the Shia communities of Italy. The author is the Iranian expat and Palermo-based Minu Mishahwalad, an established academic researcher with a vast portfolio of publications on Islamic law and Iran's history. Mirshah Balad's work was carried out in the span of 3 years in 13 different Italian cities, mostly in the north of Italy, where the bulk of the Shia communities reside.
A large number of Shias have moved to Italy's wealthy north for work-related reasons. According to rough estimations, they make up about 5 to 10% of the 2.5 million Muslims residing in Italy. The majority of them are from Pakistan, Iran, Afghanistan, and Lebanon. And then we have the Italians who have converted to Shia Islam.
Immigrants from Pakistan and the Indian subcontinent are very active in social events and religious rituals, such as the large Ashura ceremony in front of the Milan Central Station. However, also political activism is widespread, particularly among Shias living in Rome, with events organized in solidarity with the assassinated top Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani.
12-hour Shias generally organize more events and commemorations compared to Sunni Muslims residing in Italy. Another important aspect of my research shows how among the Shia faithfuls are today also a growing number of Italians. They have found in the Shia Islam a spiritual and political place where they can stand against the U.S. and Israeli's hegemony, where their traditional family values and love for artistic expression are welcomed.
About 2.5 million Muslims are living in Italy, making Islam the country's second largest religion. However, unlike Christianity and Judaism, Islam isn't formally recognized, meaning that mosques cannot receive public financing support, Islamic marriages have no legal force, and Muslim workers aren't entitled to take days off for religious festivities.
Mirshak Khvalad's research book also examines how Shia religious leaders in Italy interact with Shia religious authorities in a diasporic context. Max Civili, Rome.
It's what occupation looks like. U.S. troops wander around an independent country without any legal justification, invitation, or UN mandate. The U.S. officially intervened in Syria in 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh, something Syria dismisses as lies. The military prosecution in Syria held a press conference asserting it has collected evidence of U.S. Daesh cooperation in Syria.
The military prosecution in Syria obtained material evidence that the U.S. has almost direct control over Daesh and its terrorist activities in Syria using its illegal base in Al-Tanf. We have proof that many Daesh terrorists are being trained by U.S. forces in that base. We monitor the terrorists moving freely there with their weapons and vehicles.
For years, the U.S. has been looting Syria's oil after occupying areas in the oil-rich north and northeastern territories. The military prosecution in Syria vowed to judicially pursue the U.S. for all its crimes.
The result of our investigations into the U.S. violations in Syria, which led to destruction and casualties, threat to our sovereignty, theft of oil and wheat, illegitimate sanctions, and control over Daesh on territories of a U.N. member state, enables us in the near future to officially make accusations against the U.S. administration and its forces in Syria.
The military prosecution also accused the U.S. of promoting division by supporting a separatist ideology among the so-called SDF, providing them with weapons and ensuring they get all Syria's oil, let alone the U.S. airstrikes, which killed or displaced thousands of Syrians and destroyed its infrastructure. It hasn't been a day or two, a month or a year. It's been almost 8 uninterrupted years of U.S. violations in Syria, at least since the intervention of the U.S.-led coalition. But regardless of how much time they're planning to stay, Syrian officials don't spare a chance to reiterate that their country will be liberated from terrorism and illegal foreign presence. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Protests against a highly divisive bill have intensified in London as debates rage inside Westminster. The Nationality and Borders Bill has several controversial clauses which minority groups have accused of being racist and turning black and brown Brits into second-class citizens.
The fight over this clause is far from over. It remains in the House of Lords, who are debating the various controversial clauses which remain as part of this wide bill. Now, there is a lot of division to various clauses, and if the Lords decide that they want amendments to it, it will bounce back to Parliament.
The bill seeks to provide the Home Office with additional powers to revoke citizens' nationality status and deny access to refugees fleeing to Britain. The government have offered reassurances, with Home Secretary Priti Patel claiming the law would be used only in exceptional circumstances on people who pose the most risk to the UK.